This is Due South, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham. I'm Jeff Tabiri. More than 57,000 people woke up behind bars in North Carolina this morning. For context, that's greater than the populations of Boone, Elizabeth City, and Pinehurst combined. About half of these people are in state prisons. Thousands more are incarcerated at federal facilities, and some are being housed in local jails. The vast majority of these inmates will one day rejoin the outside world, deemed to have been rehabilitated, having served their time, forgiven, perhaps even redeemed on some level for their illegalities and criminal transgressions. However, some of these people will never again be free. They will die behind bars. And while North Carolina has not executed a prisoner in almost 18 years due to a de facto moratorium on capital punishment, a very small group of these convicts, 136 to be precise, exist, perhaps you could say live, on death row. What does rehabilitation look like for them? Can a person ever truly serve multiple life sentences? Is there even a possibility for redemption after committing some of the most heinous acts? Today we're exploring those questions and sharing the story of one such man. He is a triple murderer, and while we will not spend time on his victims today, let us say the names of the people he killed. Emmanuel Oguayo, Donald Ray Bryant, Dwayne Maurice Caldwell. He was born Michael Jerome Braxton on June 1, 1974. Today, he goes by Aleem. Aleem Braxton has written a new book titled Rap and Redemption, and we recently spoke to him on the phone from Central Prison in Raleigh.
So my name is Michael Braxton, but I'm, you know, more personally known as Aleem, which is my Muslim name, but also have my stage name that I perform under as the MC, known as Rome Alone. That's spelled two R's, R-R-O-M-E, alone. I'm calling from Central Prison. I'm on death row. I've been incarcerated for actually 31 years now, and I've been on death row since 1997.
Why are you in prison?
I'm originally in prison for two counts of murder, like four robberies and a kidnapping that occurred in Raleigh, Wake County, back in 1993. And while I was in prison, I was originally convicted and sentenced to two life sentences plus 110 years. And then in 1996, while I was incarcerated at Caledonia, serving my time, I killed a fellow inmate. And for that, I received death sentence.
Three killings, three murders. And
yes, unfortunately.
Do you dispute? We hear often about people who are, wrongfully incarcerated. Are you wrongfully incarcerated?
I am not. I accept full responsibility for the crimes that I committed. I'm deeply remorseful for those crimes. And, you know, I'm not contesting the fact that I am culpable for what the crimes that were committed.
How often do you think about the victims, and how often do you think about the victims' families?
Well, I definitely think about them, you know, in moments where I'm discussing the realities of my convictions and, you know, what I'm here for. The fact that it's been quite some time. It's, you know, been 31 years since I've been incarcerated. And, you know, 1996 was the year in which the murder in prison happened. So, you know, I have been able to find, you know, some peace of mind and, you know, inner closure for myself and accepting responsibility for those crimes. So it isn't something that I, you know, ponder or, you know, mull over daily, because it would be quite distressful. But I am mindful of the people that, you know, the lives that were lost in order, you know, for me to, you know, be here today and, you know what I'm saying, to, you know, be able to speak and do things, you know, writing books. I'm completely conscious at all times that it's, you know, it's at a consequence of people's lives that people even know who I am. And, you know, that comes with a great deal of, you know, responsibility and, you know, and the grief that I have, you know, is continual in that capacity.
I want you to give us a little glimpse, if you would, about you. Who are you? Are you religious?
Do you pray five times a day? Do you love chicken? Do you love basketball? I'm telling you some of the things that I love. These are my biases here. Tell us just a little bit about you. What makes you tick? What gets you excited in the morning? What makes you sad in the morning?
Yeah, I'm Muslim. I'm deeply religious. It's my faith that, you know, has given me guidance and, you know, given me purpose in life. You know, something that I know that I'm striving for, which is something greater than this life. You know, I'm resigned to the reality of, you know, my life in prison is, you know, a high probability that I may never get out of prison, and it's a possible that I also may be executed. So I find the strength in my faith and striving towards, you know, a life on the other side of this life. And so that's definitely, you know, the full, you know, aspect of who I am. Mm-hmm. So I'm a Muslim first and foremost. You know, some of my likes, of course, yeah, I like chicken and basketball too. You know, but I'm a huge football fan. I love Pittsburgh Steelers.
Uh-oh.
That's my team. I enjoy watching the Super Bowl. Kansas City won. I love playing fantasy football for fun.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a fantasy football roster, and you know, of course, I have a strong connection with my family and friends. I've been blessed to have the support of, you know, my family throughout the years of my incarceration, and as well as, you know, meeting some new friends that have, you know, also been great supports for me, and, you know, communicating with them and staying in touch with them. And, you know, I also have a strong support system in here. I've been able to develop some great friendships with some of the people that are also incarcerated on death row. And, you know, we have, you know, many engaged from conversations and, you know, just joy and good times and just chatting and, you know, doing daily activities.
I want to build on some of what you're talking about. And I think it's important. There's quite a juxtaposition here, right? Like you have killed three people. You do not dispute that. And I think for some people, when they hear about, you know, they hear about criminals, they hear about somebody on death row, they think of the worst of society. And I'm not casting judgment one way or another here. But that's how some people look at a story like this and a scenario like this. And you're also talking about friendships and fantasy football and good times, I think was a phrase you just used, on death row. And
yeah.
I this is messy. This is complicated. And I want to lean in, so to speak, to this a little bit. And I want to take this phone call that we're on right now. You called us. One of our producers noted to me that you and other inmates on death row in North Carolina, for a time, only got one phone call a year. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Until 2016, when we were had access to...
This call is from a North Carolina correctional facility.
Like what we have now. Yeah, we had one call a year, and that was during the Christmas holidays throughout the month of December. We were able to make one 10-minute phone call a year up until 2016. And then, you know, we got access to regular phone calls, such as, you know, what I'm, you know, calling you on this call now. And, you know, you're right. You know, that there is a huge, you know, confusion here. Is that I recognize is that a lot of the things that I, you know, am granted, whether if it's access to the telephone, whether if it's, you know, being able to enjoy, you know, a good conversation or play fantasy football or any of those things, is that I see those as huge mercies that have, you know, been extended to someone in my situation. It's not something that I take for granted. I did, you know, approximately 10 years in solitary confinement, you know, for my actions in prison. And as a consequence of that, is, you know, I didn't have access to, you know, even, you know, touch a human being for many years. And so, you know, to be in a position where, you know, I've been deprived of, you know, many of the things that we can obviously take for granted, to just have those things, as I know that I'm not deserving of any of those things. And so I recognize, you know, in my life as being things that are mercies.
Solitary confinement for, I believe it was between 7.5 and 10 years. Tell me what has lingered with you. So just to back up, you committed a murder in prison with a homemade weapon. You went into solitary confinement after that. You know, you went from a double life sentence to death row, and you spent 7.5 years in solitary confinement. What kinds of lingering impacts are there for you, whether it's auditory or visual or, you know, how did that change you, spending 7.5 years in solitary confinement?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, I best characterize it as saying that, you know, I got to a point where, you know, I lost my mind. I became extremely, extremely paranoid. I was extremely, extremely dangerous. There's no question about that. A lot of things you can't see in solitary, so you depend more on your hearing. My hearing became, you know, my eyes. When I was doing solitary, during the time from 97 to 2004, is that it was extremely, extremely aggressive. And so some of the things that I experienced, as well as seeing, you know, attacks, the sound of batons, you know, hitting arms or legs or heads and fat and bone and muscle, you know, the ears are able to just hear those things and make the distinctions. And, the sounds of, you know, people crying or pleading, et cetera. Those are some of the sounds that definitely are imprinted into my mind from, you know, that period of incarceration and solitary confinement. And, you know, it had a huge impact on me. It's like I said, it's, you know, almost by the time I was released from solitary, is that I had become extremely paranoid and violent. I was filled with hate and anger. And, you know, I didn't have any, you know, prospects or see any light at the end of the tunnel, so to speak. You know, I was in a pit of despair, in a deep abyss.
How do you get to this point where you and I can have a conversation?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I'll call you back, and I'll touch that on when I get back.
Aleem Braxton has written a new book titled Rap and Redemption, and is releasing an album that he made from Central Prison in Raleigh. Aleem was limited to 15 minutes per phone call, prison rules. He calls back in a minute. Hope you'll stay with us. This is Due South. Michael Aleem Braxton is with us. Hey, Michael, or hey, Aleem. Aleem Braxton, birth name Michael, is with us here on Due South, and we're chatting about his life, his journey. He is on death row, and we're going to talk about some of the projects that he has been working on here in a moment. But I want to ask you, you talk about this period of time, not 7.5 weeks or 7.5 months, 7.5 years, two presidential terms that you spent in solitary confinement. You said, you used the words despair. You said you were dangerous. You felt violent and paranoid. And here we are, many years later, able to have a conversation. You've written a book, which we're going to talk about. You've produced a rap album, which we're going to talk about. How did you turn the corner? Was it through therapy? Was it through your village? How did you not lose it, quite bluntly?
Well, like I said, I did lose it. You know, as they say, like in, you know, AA or, you know, substance abuse programs, everybody has a rock bottom that they hit. And, you know, I did come to a point where I felt a huge amount of despair. I didn't see any point of, you know, life. I didn't want to live anymore. I didn't want to, you know, continue to be in this environment. I didn't want to spend the rest of my life in prison. I felt like my life was pointless, that everything that I did, that I had, you know, let down so many people that believed in me and loved in me in life. And I just felt so disgusted with who I had become. And, you know, it was in that particular moment is that I was searching for answers. I was searching for some type of guidance. And I remember I had, you know, started learning about Islam several years prior, but I didn't really believe in the faith in that capacity until I was really contemplating death. And so it was when I was contemplating death is that I began to search for answers in the Quran. And, you know, one of the things that I found, you know, was the statement that, you know, does man think that he will be left without purpose, without aim, is that I believe, and I had to believe that my life had to have a purpose as well, and that it wasn't just to, you know, come to this earth to live a period of time to be destructive and evil and to die and then, you know, leave no memory or no legacy on this earth and, you know, it's over then, that there's nothing after that. And then I came in contact with this axiom that says, the decisions that you make today determine your tomorrow. And I came to a realization that this was gradual. And I'm glad you asked me this because, you know, it's been so long since I've been living and walking in the path that I'm living today that it's, you know, it's so much difference, distance and separation from that, is that it's, you know, it's easy for me to detach. And you know, because I'm not that person anymore. But you know, when I came to a realization that the decisions that you made today determine your tomorrow, it was a light that went on in my mind. And I realized that I was there where I was at in life at that particular moment, whether if it was despair, whether if it was hopelessness, whether if it was a life of evil and hatred and anger, that I was there based upon the decisions that I had made in my yesterdays. And that if that was the case, is that my fate and my future was not set in stone, is that I could do something about it, that I could change the outcome of how this story ends, this life, this book of Michael Arlene Braxton that I have been writing of my conduct, of my deeds, is that I could do something about that. And that gave me a great sense of hope. It gave me power. It made me feel that I was not at the whim of, you know, a mighty system, that I was the master of my fate, the controller of my destiny. And that's where I began. And, you know, it's been a gradual, you know, process until we are where we are today.
Yeah. I don't usually do this with people I'm interviewing who I can't see, but for whatever reason, I'm just going to be real honest here. I'm having this, I'm talking to you and I'm like, I want a better sense of what you look like. Right, like you're Muslim. Like I'm like, is he wearing a kufi hat right now? Does he have a beard? Is he 6'2"? Is he 5'7"?
I'm 6'1". I'm 350 pounds.
Okay.
I have a full beard. That's white. I'm 50. You know, I'm not wearing a kufi right now. I'm bald.
Okay.
That's a basic description of my appearance.
No, and I appreciate it. And what are you wearing? Are you wearing what are you wearing?
Right now, I'm wearing a state-issue gray T-shirt and black shorts.
If you would, I want you to tell me what the word... So your book is titled Rap and Redemption, and I want you to define for me what redemption... define the word redemption from your perspective.
Well, you know, redemption, you know, for me, of course, as I mentioned and I've talked about throughout the course of this conversation, is something that I see as, you know, being saved from, you know, the life that, you know, you've lived. You've, you know, being given another opportunity, being, you know, turning away from that life and, you know, being redeemed or saved from that. So, and for me, redemption is in the bigger capacity is what I'm striving for with God, is that the things that I have done in my life is that I'm striving that he will not only forgive me, but that he will turn me away from those things and turn me to a life that is pleasing to him. To me, that's redemption. You know, and as we haven't mentioned, but in one of the capacities that I have been striving to do this is that since I've been incarcerated on death row, it's been a mind-blowing experience. You know, we got a tendency to project. So when I got to death row is that I assumed that everybody here was just like me, you know, and I consider myself probably one of the worst people, and I deserve the fate that I got, is that I'm not sitting here and saying, hey, some injustice has happened to me. If I was a juror with rational sense and listened to the things that I've done, I would have said the same thing. This man deserves to be punished. He doesn't deserve any mercy. So I had the same attitude when I got here, that I felt and figured that all of the people around me were just as bad as I was, that they deserved to be here. And my mind was literally blown when I discovered that there were innocent people here. Not just to my own understanding, but I saw people that were exonerated, that were getting new trials, that, you know, went to trial again. Alan Jale got a new trial in like 2006 and was exonerated, was found not guilty. And I saw that, you know, Henry McCollum, who was the first prisoner in the United States to actually be found innocent, not guilty, but innocent by a panel of judges on the actual Innocence Commission in North Carolina. And it's just changed.
This call is from a North Carolina correctional facility.
It made me look at the people around me and realize, wait, man, you know, who are these guys that I just assumed were just like me? And so in my attempt to get to know people is that I discovered that there are other people here that I truly, genuinely believe are innocent as well. And there's a verse in the Quran that says to take a life, to take an innocent life, is like killing all of humanity. And to save an innocent life is like saving all of humanity. So I did an analysis. I processed that, and I said, man, Aline, you know, you're guilty of killing three people. guilty of killing humanity three times over. What can I do in God's eyes to ever try to make amends for the things that I've done? And I realized that if I strove and tried to redeem or save an innocent person here on death row, to get him exonerated, to work on his behalf, to do something that isn't just for me, to do something for somebody other than myself, to make my life's work and my efforts be about something more important to me, is that I believe that that can earn me redemption in God's eyes. And so that's been what has, you know, been my catalyst and what has, you know, continued to inspire me to work and writing this book and to, you know, do this album, is because I'm truly, genuinely trying to generate attention for an innocent person, Stacy Sabor Tyler, a friend of mine who's innocent here on death row. I want to generate attention for him. I wrote a song that's on my album that also we're producing a video for, and we're trying to generate not only attention, but hopefully have people to contribute and hire a good attorney to be able to represent him and get him exonerated. So this is one of the goals of why I've been working in the things that I've been working for the last several years.
The verbiage you use, I think, probably answers my next question, but you talk about striving. You talk about seeking redemption. You're not there yet, or are you?
Well, you know, I don't think I will ever feel that I've accomplished redemption. And of course, this, you know, only Allah can determine, you know, when you have, you know, done anything that is satisfying to him. But I'm conscious of not only the things that I have done in my past days, but, you know, the fact that I'm a human and I have mistakes and I make errors and decisions or judgments or, you know, et cetera. So in the capacity of feeling like that I've ever been redeemed, is that that's a lifelong process. It's not something that you know, I feel like you can reach some mark or goal and say, I made it and I can hang my hat up and and life is over and it's time, you know, to retire. I don't look at it like that. This is something that's, you know, continual. In Islam, we call it, I know the popular people accept or know the word jihad is the popular word, and they equate it to holy war, but it's what's called Jihad Akbar, which is the greatest jihad. And the greatest jihad is the jihad against yourself, the fighting, the struggling against yourself and against the ideas of evil that Satan may whisper to you. And that's a lifelong process. That never ends. So, you know, I'm in a constant effort to struggle and to fight and to strive for God's pleasure. And that is the process of redemption for me.
I want to focus on the book and the album now. And if you've got time and ability to do, I think probably one more phone call, we would love to do that. Rap and Redemption is the book. Tell me, the guy who's talking to you on the phone from this radio studio in Durham, why I should get a copy of this book and read this book.
Well, first of all, is that, you know, the book, all of the proceeds of the book are being donated to Healing Justice, which is founded by Jennifer Thompson, who is an actual surviving victim of a rape. She wrote a book years ago called Picking Cotton. She had a terrible ordeal where she was raped, and she falsely and wrongly accused and picked the wrong person in a lineup. And as a result, this person did many years in prison before he was exonerated. But it had such a huge impact on Jennifer that she started an organization called Healing Justice that not only addresses those who have been wrongfully convicted, but also the victims from those type of crimes who have also been harmed and suffered the double harm of wrongfully accusing someone. So I wanted to donate all of the proceeds to this book to an organization, to something that I believed in that could help not only victims of crime, but also people that have been wrongfully accused of crime. And so that would be my number one, you know, reason for saying that I hope people would support this book. As far as, you know, the contents of the book, it's about some of my experiences, my life. You know, I never imagined or thought that, you know, I would be in a position where I would write a book that people would find of interest or of any value. But in retrospect, and as I have grown, is that I think that I do have something that people may be able to benefit from, to, you know, see that not only can a person change that has gone through a life that I have gone through, that have done things so horrendous, so embarrassing. You know, it's humiliating for me to talk about these things. You know, I'm a little, you know, I feel ashamed to even have to say that, yes, I did those things, you know, many years ago, because I couldn't imagine myself doing those things ever again in my life. But nonetheless, is that I think it's important for people to see that for themselves, because we all, you know, have, you know, done things that we're not ashamed of.
You have 60 seconds remaining.
I think it's beneficial that people can also see how you can change, even when you are in, you know, some of the worst places in your life. Is you don't have to be a convicted murderer on death row and kill three people to do good. Is that there's things that, you know, you can be inspired by from my story and my experience, and hopefully, you know, it propels you to want to do something good and to help somebody else and put other people before yourself.
Aleem, I want to spend a few minutes on music, and I want to start with this.
Yeah.
Has music always been an important part of your life?
It has. I mean, you know, some of my oldest memories are, you know, connected to music. You know, I got into hip hop probably around the age of 10, and it's been one consistent in my life until this day. It's one of the very few things that I've been able to enjoy as also able to do on both sides of the wall.
Mm-hmm.
I started rapping when I was about 13, and, you know, I love to write, and it's been therapeutic for me throughout my incarceration.
Tell me a little bit, was it Public Enemy, Curtis Blow, was it Eric B. and Rakim? Who was it that you gravitated toward and loved early on in the hip-hop scene?
Oh, it was all of the above. You know, I definitely, you know, in different eras of my life, as I was definitely, you know, pulled more strongly in some directions as opposed to others. Some of my first, you know, greatest influences were the Fat Boys. You know, that's when I was a kid. That's what drew me into hip hop.
Yeah.
It was the Fat Boys, and then LL Cool J. You know, he was, you know, my greatest rapper of all time. But eventually, Eric B. and Rakim, and then KRS-One was such a huge mm-hmm. influence on me. I think he influences my style today, and, you know, using what he called edutainment. You know, to try to educate people through lyricism, and also his, you know, approach of being a teacher. And, you know, the storytelling aspect of hip-hop. So KRS-One is definitely one of my greatest influences early, but then eventually Ice Cube. I was definitely highly influenced by, you know, West Coast gangster hip-hop.
Mm-hmm.
It had a huge influence on my life and my actions. And, you know, I wanted to emulate a lot of the, you know, posturing and the things that I heard in the music in the early 90s, you know, from about 88, 89, 90, 91. Had a huge impact on.
This call is from a North Carolina correctional facility.
And it's been a continual evolution since then.
So you have created a rap album. Remind us the title of the rap album real quick and how many tracks are on it.
Mercy on My Soul. It's 14 songs.
Okay.
It's a short journey of my life over the last 30 years.
I don't mean to sound like silly or sarcastic with this, but as a reminder, you are on death row. You are incarcerated. You are spending your living days here on earth behind bars. So functionally, how in the world have you created, how have you recorded and produced a rap album? How have you functionally done this?
Yeah, it's been an amazing journey. It's something that I never even thought possible. You know, I've been writing rhymes, as I said, you know, since my entire imprisonment, and it's been therapeutic for me. Many of those rhymes I just kept, you know, in envelopes, large manila envelopes for years and years and years, and it was probably around 2016 is that a friend of mine asked me, why you keep all those rhymes? And, you know, I just felt like offended, like he was implying that I should, you know, throw them away. And, you know, I told him, I said, you know, this is my life, man. This is what I love. And he said, well, what good are they if nobody ever hears them? And when he said it, it just kind of like struck a chord in me. But I realized that I had the ability to, you know, protect myself and think and imagine and live in a fantasy bubble saying that, you know, if I never got into this trouble, that I could have been one of the greatest of all time, you know, to believe in myself and, you know, living that idea as opposed to actually doing something about it and seeing, you know, if I was really as good as I believed that I was. And so just that conversation, it sparked me to say, you know what, I'm going to see what I can do. And like I said, we got telephones in 2016. And so as soon as we got telephones, it wasn't a far stretch. And I saw the progress of technology and mm-hmm. just imagine. I said, well, maybe I can record my raps over the phone. And, you know, that's what happened. I recorded over the phone. Eventually, I met some Michael Betts, who's, you know, a great friend of mine, an audio documentarian. And, you know, he began putting acapellas of mine on SoundCloud back in 2018. And, you know, we did that for a year. And then I seen a news article in the paper about Mark Katz, professor at UNC, music director, that he had a beat lab and he was teaching kids how to produce tracks. And so I wrote to him with the hopes that, you know, maybe one of those kids could help me with a beat to put to my acapellas. And, you know, through Mark Katz, he introduced me to Nick Neutrons, who is the producer that I work with today out of New York. And the process has just been growing and evolving since then.
Your collaborator on the album and also in the book, Mark Katz, professor at UNC Chapel Hill, who our listeners are going to hear from as part of this hour here on Due South. He told us something that struck us afterward. He said that he views making music, producing music, as a human right. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, that's pretty profound. I never looked at it in that capacity. You know, as I said, you know, for me personally, as I know how therapeutic music has been, you know, and, you know, if that can be equated as being, you know, something the person has a right to, then, you know, maybe there's an argument for that, you know. But I know that personally for myself is that, you know, I don't know if I could have sorted out and worked out a lot of the internal, you know, issues that I had if it wasn't for music, and particularly in the creative aspect. It was my writing. It was the process of me going inside of my soul, going inside of my heart and my mind, bringing up thoughts and ideas that, you know, I didn't have words for, feelings. You know, a lot of times we have feelings and we don't know how to describe them. But it was through the art, the artistry of rhyming, that I was able to find words to explain how I felt, what I thought. And, you know, it was so therapeutic for me. And it continues to be so to this day.
Aleem Braxton has written a new book titled Rap and Redemption and is releasing an album that he made from Central Prison in Raleigh, where he is incarcerated and on death row. Welcome back. It is Due South on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Tabiri, and we're spending the hour talking about redemption. We're talking largely about the case, the story, the life of Aleem Braxton, who is serving multiple life sentences, and he is also the co-author of a new book, and he is the lead vocalist on a new hip-hop album as well.
You know, I would like to just, you know, circle back, you know, to the earlier part of the conversation, and as I say, you know, sometimes it's very, you know, it's very easy for me to become accustomed to the person that I am now, you know, but I recognize that I can't separate my past from who I am no more than I can separate my chest from my back. And so it's easy for me to get into a conversation and meet someone and talk to them in the capacity of who I am today. And, you know, not take into consideration or account the huge realities of the fact that, yes, I am on death row. Yes, I have killed three people. And, you know, I didn't, you know, I didn't want to make light of that or feel like that, you know, that I was presenting myself as being that those were footnotes to my reality, because they are huge, you know, aspects of why I am here and who I am today. So I just wanted to touch back on that and also say, you know, that, you know, in the capacity of my enjoying things like, you know, fantasy football or, you know, enjoying a good conversation with friends. And as I mentioned, those are things that I see as huge mercies in life, the things that I know that I'm not deserving of. So just to have...
This call is from a North Carolina correctional facility.
Just to have the sweetness of benefiting from things that many people often take for granted in life, you know, is something that I take great pleasure in. And I'm truly grateful for those mercies that I have throughout my day. So I just wanted to touch on those things just briefly.
Sure.
You know, before we end it.
Tell me about a couple of tracks on the album. Give me the name of a track or two, and just give us a sense of what the song is about.
Yeah, sure. So one of the songs that I have that I'm really, you know, excited about is a song called One Life. And as I mentioned, you know, it's based on the Quranic verse that, you know, to, you know, kill a person is like killing all of humanity, but to save a life is like saving all of humanity. And that song I wrote it, and it's, telling some of the struggle of Stacey Sabour Tyler, who I have been advocating for and that I'm going to continue to advocate for because he's an innocent man on death row. So that's one of the songs that's on the album. But
pardon me, sir. Did you say there's an innocent man on death row?
Yeah, and it's an emergency. He needs help.
I'm sorry, sir, but we're not equipped to deal with emergencies of this kind.
But you don't understand. They're going to kill him.
Sir, could you please explain what's going on?
You ever wish you could change an injustice, correct the wrong, that's a shame and disgusting, remove pain of someone aching and suffering? Now is the time we have got to do something.
The album is so full. You know, I have Prisoner of War, which is the first song on the album, which is a brief synopsis of my life and experiences. It's very autobiographical. And then I have a song called It Ain't Just Me, which is, a song that, is kind of a social justice song and talks about some of the realities on the outside, since, the death of George Floyd and, many of the, protest movements that happened in 2020. And then I have songs, that talk about Welcome to Death Row, to just talk about the reality on death row. I have a song, Mercy on My Soul, which is the namesake of the album, that talks about, my experience going to trial. And then I have more lighter songs like The Good Stuff, which is just a song just about being grateful for the small things that we often overlook in life.
That's the good and stuff. And I walk down the street whistling this. I walk down the street whistling this. I walk down the street whistling this. Feeling out of place, cause man, do I miss the good stuff. Good stuff. Sometimes I think about life as I made it, and all the days I wake up jaded, feeling so agitated from the fate that I created, and reminisce on the very premise of.
And, I have an ode to my mom, a song I have called Three Words that I just, my mother loves so much that, it's just acknowledging all of the hardship that, she has endured, but yet still loving and supporting me. So, the album is, I feel like it's, obviously I'm biased, but I'm also a huge hip hop fan, so I try to be objective, but I feel like this is really a great album and one of the greats.
Michael Alleyne Braxton has been our guest here on Due South. He's been on the phone line from Central Prison in Raleigh, North Carolina. Alleyne, I want to say thank you for the conversation and assalamu alaikum.
Thank you as well. Wa alaikum salam.
After our interview, Alleyne called us back. He said there was something else he wanted to say.
Jeff asked me what redemption meant earlier, and I gave a broad definition that was otherworldly and seemed to have no bearing on what I hope to achieve in regards to redemption in this life. But I want to be very clear and honest. I hope one day to be free, not just free from death row and a sentence of pending execution, but freedom from prison altogether. I know that might sound audacious, and I believe President Obama coined the phrase, the audacity of hope. But that's a hope that I cling to. And that's one of the reasons why I'm doing this work to help other people. I want to show the world that I'm productive, that I've reformed, that I've accepted responsibility for my crimes, and that I'm trying to make amends. And while I know I may not deserve another chance at life, I'm throwing myself at the feet of humanity, and I'm pleading for mercy. I say that is because in the earlier part of the interview, when, we talked about, the crimes that I committed, 31 years ago and approximately 28 years ago, is that, those things are like so distant from me and who I am today. But of course, I'm conscious that whenever I meet or speak to somebody new, this is the first thing that they know about me. But it's hard for me to like identify with that mind state or that mentality. And so I have to like go back into, a mind that I had 30 years ago to try to explain, the wrongs and the things that I did that led me along those paths. So that's just what I wanted to, say in a little bit in regards to some of the people that know me today.
Braxton says he has prevented violence and helped other men on death row try to find a better way.
Much of the good that I've done over the past decade plus is largely unknown outside of these walls. But the people I live among, men who have been judged to be the worst of the worst and condemned to die, see me not only as a man of exemplary character, but also a source of hope as well. That's why I want to free myself from these chains to prove that redemption is possible in this life, even for the worst of us. I want to be a beacon of hope for others in prison, just like me, to know that there is a way out. And it's my faith in Allah first and foremost, but also my faith in the human race and its capacity to extend mercy to those who truly put forth a sincere effort to obtain it. And that's what redemption looks like for me in this life.
You've heard primarily from Aleem Braxton so far this hour, a triple murderer living on death row in Raleigh, in Central Prison. We're going to speak now with Mark Katz. Katz is co-author of Rap and Redemption on Death Row. He wrote the book with Aleem Braxton, and we're talking about his friendship with Aleem here on Due South. Mark is also a professor of music at UNC Chapel Hill, and he has an executive producer credit on the album that Aleem is getting ready to release to the public. It's called Mercy on My Soul. If you would, I want to start with just kind of a big question. I want you to tell me what the word redemption means to you.
Redemption. You know, it's interesting that you're asking me to think about that, because I've thought about it quite deeply in terms of Aleem's story and arc. But I think to redeem yourself is to make good on your potential, to make good on the promise of your life. And I do see that definition working both kind of generally, if I think about redemption in my own life, but also the story of Aleem. It's about, it means, I think redemption also means or suggests the possibility of change, and suggests that one is not irredeemably bad or evil or unable to improve or transcend your circumstances.
Surely there are situations that are irredeemable.
I've used that word. I've used the word irredeemable, but I would say it's, when I hear it, it's usually kind of tossed around pretty lightly. Like, you know, this traffic is irredeemably bad,
and okay.
But I'd have to think hard about whether I think anything is truly irredeemable, because I do wonder whether, given enough time, given the will, given changing circumstances, that anything could be redeemed. I don't know. There are people, historical figures, people walking around right now, that if you asked me, I'd probably say, yeah, probably not redeemable.
A letter that you received out of the blue from Aleem. I want you to tell me when it came, and as you recall, what you thought when you opened up this letter and you received your first correspondence from somebody who was on death row serving multiple life sentences.
So I received my first letter from Aleem Braxton on August 19th, 2019, and it came to my faculty mailbox at UNC, and the first thing I noticed was the printing on the envelope that said mailed from Central Prison. So that immediately got my attention. So I opened it right there. I was standing right in front of the mailbox, opened it and read it. And the first words that came out, well, it said, "Dear Mr. Mark Katz," and I don't have it in front of me, but basically it said, I'm a reformed prisoner, North Carolina's death row, and I saw an article about you in the News and Observer recently, and saw that you're interested in hip hop, and I'm wondering if you could help me find a producer, because I'm recording songs over the prison phone, and I need help. And a number of things went through my mind when I saw that. First was kind of trepidation, because after I read it, I thought, geez, you know, should I actually respond to this person? I don't know who he is. If he's on death row, you know, there's probably a good reason. And I didn't go look him up right then. I did later. And one thing that struck me it was just how neat his handwriting was. And just there was something, it wasn't just that it was neat. It seemed earnest to me. And then I just sat on it for a couple of months because I really didn't know what to do. I went and looked up his story. I saw that he had been convicted of 3 murders. I wondered, like, what would happen if I connected with him? You know, could there be any danger to me or even my family? So those were some of the thoughts that went through my head. But obviously, I decided to respond to him.
What eventually got you to write back? And was it a handwritten note back, or was it a letter that was typed out?
So I actually wrote him a postcard. I don't know what convinced me to do that, but I wrote a postcard. I just went back and forth. Why get in touch with this guy? I kind of put the question to myself, which was something like, does everyone have a right to express themselves through music? Are there limits to that right? And in thinking through that and over time, I decided for myself that I think that the right to express oneself and to do so through music is a human right. So if something is a human right, you can't say, well, what about if this human does really terrible things? Well, is this person human? Then that person has the right.
And are they alive?
And are they alive? Right. And so given that, I decided to just go ahead and do it.
Is Aleem Braxton, who killed 3 people and now trying to share his message in hopes of preventing others from going down a similar path, is he redeemed?
I don't feel like it's for me to say that he's been redeemed. I would say my feeling is that he is, that redemption is a process rather than a product. So my view is that he is constantly redeeming himself. I guess I would just phrase it differently just for myself. Like, I almost have to set that aside because I have to remind myself of the families. Would they ever say that he's been redeemed? Maybe some would.
Sure.
Maybe some would forgive him. I can only speak for myself. And what I would say, and this doesn't necessarily mean he's been redeemed or not, but I don't think he's a danger to society. I think he has a lot to offer society in terms of his artistry, his intellect, he's an amazing writer. He could teach. I think he could be out in the world, and I would be confident that he wouldn't do any harm. You know, I would have no problem if he were my neighbor, but it would never be for me to say that he has been redeemed.
This question had not crossed my mind until 8 seconds ago. If Governor Roy Cooper was sitting right here, would you make a case for him to pardon Aleem Braxton and release him?
That is a really tough question. If Roy Cooper were here, I would tell him Aleem's story and ask him whether he thinks that someone who has done what Aleem has done is capable of being released. So I'm kind of evading the answer because I think our system it's just not conceivable within the system. We don't pardon people on death row unless they have been, if it's been demonstrated that they were wrongfully incarcerated. I would like this society to be one in which it is possible for people who have done all the work that Aleem has done to be a better person, to contribute to society, to be released.
Mark Katz spoke to us in our Durham studios. Michael Aleem Braxton spoke to us from Central Prison in Raleigh on the phone. Due South is a production of WUNC and a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Our producers are Stacia Brown, Cole Del Charco, and Rachel McCarthy. Denarius Thomas is our technical director. Aaron Kiever is our executive producer. For co-host Leonita Inge, I'm Jeff Tiberi.